Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com. $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And here we go on another edition of Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock, joined as always by Brandon Thurston. Brandon, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm ready to celebrate a great, you know, moment in that is a teachable moment in transformation and contrition and submission.
Well, that's very kind of you. Has anyone been yelling at you in the front row to apologize for any of your actions this week, for any of your words?
Not in the front row. Not from the front row. No.
Some people in the back.
Yeah. Some direct communications, perhaps.
Well, we are going to be discussing many topics today that we're going to get into. Brandon and I, earlier this week, we procured some of the details for this upcoming WWE Unreal series. Mm-hmm. We're going to get into that. There's some ongoing developments in regards to Liv Morgan's stalker, who was arrested in Orlando not too long ago. Tony Khan just did an interview on the Rich Eisen show, had some interesting comments in that interview that we will be getting to. But as the graphic suggests, everyone is here to talk about everyone's favorite Phil. Phil Brooks, he went on a trip over the past week. It was a heavily scrutinized one and promoted as such on WWE's own programming that here is a hypocrite, as John Cena called him. Okay, that was the storyline going into this. So don't get on me, folks. This was the storyline going into it. Okay, let the story play out. And that is what took us to Riyadh over the past week. And then maybe semi-surprising event that went down at the kickoff event on Friday. And Brandon, why don't we roll that footage of CM Punk interacting with the WWE Universe?
This guy wants me to apologize for a mean tweet I wrote 6 years ago. Hey, listen. Legitimately had nothing to do with Saudi Arabia. I woke up and I was crabby and I wrote a mean tweet to The Miz. And I apologize to The Miz. And sir, what's your name? Muhammad? Here, watch out. I'm going to step right here. Muhammad? I sincerely apologize to you and all of Saudi Arabia.
Lost in that apology that has been dissected every which way is the return of the Michael Cole fake laugh that was a staple when Vince McMahon was his producer. Ha, 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 ha. That mean tweet. Hilarious. Funny. Blood-covered dick.
The fans in Saudi Arabia were not really ready to accept his apology, it sounds like. Some of them, anyway.
So let's break this one down. What was CM Punk apologizing to Muhammad for? What had Muhammad seeked contrition over?
For insulting his the great government of where he lives, the progressive government of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, of His Excellency the General Entertainment Authority Chairman Turki Alşık, for saying that that there's blood money being handed out in Saudi Arabia.
Because if you were to ask me a week ago, does CM Punk have anything against the people of Saudi Arabia? I would have said probably not. There would be, to me, no evidence of anything that CM Punk had said.
That's the beauty of moments like this. You just conflate those two. Just conflate them right together, and nobody's going to look. There's going to be like stupid people like us that are going to be unpacking that, but the rest of them, they don't care.
Let's not parse. Why not? Let's just lump it all together. It was interesting because Paul Levesque then did not get on the stage after, and also apologized to Saudi Arabia for stoking any tensions from 2018 over a ongoing proxy war at the time by doing an angle involving Saudi Arabia and Iran, which WWE, they've also grown from, right? They've evolved from 2018, and they've shown that they've evolved.
And they cherish these opportunities that they have before them now.
Mm-hmm. So that was Punk's apology. And then, so a lot has been made of this. Now, the same fan ended up in the front row at Night of Champions, and Punk was showing with the fan the next night after Night of Champions. It was also brought to people's attention, and this is something that, to me, like, this was the first time I had seen this, was a 2019 clip that precedes the 2020 tweet that everyone had focused upon. And this one was, to me, much more direct in terms of if you want to get into the politics of CM Punk and how
he was just mad at The Miz. He was just crabby, and he was just tweeting at The Miz.
He woke up crabby one day, forgetting about this appearance several months earlier. So let us now hear CM Punk on Barstool Sports on the Pardon My Take show. Again, this was in 2019.
October 20th.
How many Saudi Arabia shows do they have to do to bring back CM Punk?
I'm not doing a single one of those.
No, I'm saying how many they have to do to get the money to pay you.
I don't know. What's the deal on that?
They make a lot of money.
This sounds so shady.
Yeah. Oh, it's very shady.
Come on.
It's very shady.
It's like backyard wrestling for MBS.
Yeah, right?
So that was, I mean, much more distinct. And again, I would not listen to that clip and think, you know what? CM Punk really doesn't like people in Saudi Arabia. I think this is a very straightforward view of an autocratic government in Saudi Arabia. And again, this is October of 2019. So we are, it's 1 year after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. It's put all of this into a timeline as well. I think that the sentiment that CM Punk espoused in 2019 was one that probably a lot of people co-signed with. And I think it's always important that, you know, when we continually talk about this topic, I think it's very important to separate the government from its people. And I think you can apply that to present day with the United States as well. But that is where this all kind of got placed together. This apology was made. There was a lot of backlash towards this. And then the final thing we'll play here is that at the post show, after Night of Champions, Paul Levesque reflected on the actions of one CM Punk.
Well, I don't know what Triple H 15 years ago would have thought, but if you'd have told me 10 years ago that CM Punk would be here in Saudi for the WWE, I would have thought you're out of your mind. But people grow, people change, people evolve, and they learn. And they learn a lot in life. And I think... not only was I privileged to watch them this week as they prepared for this fight, I was privileged to watch two men grow as people, especially CM Punk. I was privileged to watch him grow as a human being, to step out here and apologize to the people of Saudi, to just cherish where he is at in life and his career and the things he gets to do and the opportunities that he has. And I was incredibly proud of him.
Yes. This brings to mind, I think, a very memorable scene from a very famous film starring Sylvester Stallone. If I can change, you can change, everybody can change. And that ended the Cold War as well in Rocky IV.
Pretty much.
Yes. So there we have everything kind of encapsulated here of what went down. And with CM Punk, this kind of dominated the discussion going in and coming out of Saudi Arabia. I will add that while I feel there certainly would have been a lot of references to these comments Punk had made in the past, and it would have been something because of Punk wrestling in Saudi Arabia for the first time, I do maintain that had this not been part of the promotion of this match, of John Cena referencing the past tweet from 2020 and making that the you will get the title match, but you have to admit you are a hypocrite by going to Saudi Arabia. I think they just fanned the flames in terms of the amount of attention this was going to receive. So to now play that, oh, why is everyone jumping on CM Punk for this? Like, this was the story that they told on their television. And to
in
me,
an implied just, way, never saying the name of the country, Saudi Arabia, but it was strongly implied.
I mean, he literally called him a hypocrite, posted a photo of The Miz wrestling on a Saudi Arabia show on Instagram. And like, to me,
to call him a hypocrite to say that he was right in the first place to criticize and implicatively criticize Saudi Arabia. Isn't that the premise of what Cena's saying there? You're a hypocrite.
Let's go to the table.
Match like this, you're going to follow me to Saudi Arabia. And we're going to do it at Night of Champions. Ball's in your court, hero. I use CM Punk's rebellious nature and sociopathic self-confidence to back him into a corner. Where now, if CM Punk really wants to take this, he has to admit to himself that he's a hypocrite.
So that was the lead up to Night of Champions from two promos involving John Cena. So, I mean, they, at the very least, you can say they danced around this topic. But to me, it opened the floodgates to make this such a prominent part of the story. Now, if you had eliminated that angle of things with the on-screen, do you feel that this would have been the similar level of attention and backlash that CM Punk has received over this last couple of weeks?
I don't know. It might have been. I just don't have a sense of how strongly aware, you know, the typical fan who's going to an event in Saudi Arabia is of that whole backstory. They might, you know, if we're thinking about like Canadian fans, you know, they know about Montreal and things like that. So I could see it both ways.
He was booed when he first appeared on screen at mm-hmm. the kickoff show on Friday, and he received some boos at Night of Champions, but it was a pretty predominant pro CM Punk crowd. And since, you know, throughout this period in the lead up to the match and on Raw Monday night, like, it would not appear that it has affected the U.S. audience in any way. Like, you have not sensed any backlash on screen toward CM Punk. He is still viewed as a mega babyface. But if you're going from the discourse, it's a definite different tone, and you can't always equate one with the other. But that has sort of been the big focus here. And I imagine this will be somewhat lessened come the Royal Rumble next year, when Punk presumably is on that card in a prominent position. And this was sort of the, you know, as I've said in the past, ripping the Band-Aid off. That was what this event was. And they went very deep into it, including the apology. Now, Brandon penned quite the opinion piece earlier mm-hmm. this week, going through CM Punk and his actions over the past week.
Yes, because it's very unfair. A lot of people are criticizing him. He's getting a huge amount of backlash for this. And, you know, as a lot of people have pointed out, including my friend Ryan Reeves, you know, this is a global marketplace. WWE is an international company that wrestles, you know, does events all over the world. Wrestlers should want to wrestle wherever they want, everywhere. And all governments do bad things. And it's really not so much, you know, what he said, it's how he said it. And that's not good for business relationships. And it's very disrespectful to, you know, to the government, to the people, to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who kills journalists sometimes. And, you know, you can't do those things.
Have you been contacted by the government since you wrote this?
No, not yet.
You have not been assigned to a wing of the jail?
No, they treat, you know, they treat foreigners differently. So the citizens get the worst of it, it seems.
I say that half jokingly, that if you were a citizen of Saudi Arabia, yeah, you writing that would be...
I might get lured to an embassy and dismembered.
You may have a bunk in the 2-2 wing. So why do you feel it is that CM Punk is Like, all of these performers go on these Saudi Arabia shows. I am sure many of them.
Let's do the whatabouts. What about Cody? Why don't you criticize Cody? Why don't you criticize Becky Lynch's women's rights issues over there? What about them?
What would be your response of why CM Punk has received such attention more than any other performer, that even some that have refused to go in past events that are now all on board, and now, to our understanding, everyone is going on these shows?
He could have gone and not apologized. He could have just gone. Yeah, go ahead.
I wouldn't have expected this to happen on Saudi Arabia soil, but I think there is a way of which CM Punk could have handled this, in that it's not like CM Punk was viewed as this person that, again, it was never the people of Saudi Arabia, which is who the apology was directed toward. And I would think that there are plenty of citizens in Saudi Arabia who would understand Punk's positioning. I'm sure that there are many Americans that look at the leadership in the U.S. and do not co-sign with that. I think you can have that level of separation in your politics. But I think with a CM Punk, he is not making that deciphering of my attitude towards some of the actions of this government. I do not agree with. I don't agree when there are issues of injustice in the U.S. that I've been very prominent about. And how has Saudi Arabia, what has advanced that would change Punk's viewpoint from 2019 to 2025? That would be my question. What has shown you that it's different from 2019 than it is now?
Difference is that he works for WWE now. The difference between him and anybody else who wrestles in Saudi Arabia for WWE is they didn't apologize for, in essence, criticizing the government. They didn't criticize the government in the first place. Well, maybe they should, but they didn't. And they didn't go back and do what Punk did in front of the world on Friday. And I think something that we need to point out about the whataboutisms, about what about the rest of the world? And the U.S. does a lot of bad things. You know, a lot of countries do a lot of bad things. So how is it fair to get all up in arms about this event that they do twice a year? And they're bringing women's matches into these events that have never been there before, that have seldom been in the region before. Isn't this a good thing? How can you be, you know, critical of a government when I am sitting in a country that's overseen by a government that does lots of things you could say are human rights abuses. The difference is that the WWE or no other wrestling company is putting on a show that's meant to enhance the image of that government worldwide for the world to see on Netflix and on Peacock. They're not going to Ottawa and promoting the great government of Canada. They're not going to Washington, D.C. and putting on a show to promote the image of the Trump administration or the Biden administration, whoever your least favorite politician is. The only thing like this, the only thing I can think of that is like these Saudi events that happen twice a year, where they're, by the way, paid an inordinate amount of money. They're paid, you know, what is essentially a WrestleMania at this point, a two-day WrestleMania for one event twice a year. The only thing like this that you could really do a what about is Collision in Korea. Why weren't you writing about this in 1995? What about Collision in Korea? Why are you protecting New Japan and Antonio Inoki? That's the point to make. Sorry, I was 10 years old. There's really nothing else like this. And if WWE put on, you know, went and did a WrestleMania at the presidential inauguration, that would be the analogy. That's not happening though.
And you know, when we heard, like, there was the talks of if Donald Trump was even going to show up at WrestleMania, I think you absolutely would have seen a lot of criticism. And that's not a case of the WWE is being paid something to put Trump in a positive light and identify on screen. It would be a president attending an event. I think that would have gotten tons of scrutiny. And my closest comparison would be to some of the UFC shows where they have absolutely placed, like, the Donald Trump and his administration, and they get tons of blowback for that.
And just to insert, we did talk a few weeks ago about the appearance that Cody Rhodes, Tiffany Stratton, and the Street Profits made at Fort Bragg, that in an event that turned out to be a Trump rally, in essence.
Yes, the those I I give people the benefit of the doubt that they ask these what about questions in good faith. But I think a lot of the times when you are faced with these geopolitical dilemmas and you're resorting to, well, you use an iPhone, I think you're kind of bankrupt in an argument is when you're getting to that level of comparison points. And again, if like just basic questions, why are these shows happening? Is it to bring the WWE to these fans? If that is your argument of why these shows should be happening, then ask yourselves why WWE was not doing these shows prior. They did
because there wasn't a $50 million site fee.
They did one-off shows in 2014 and 2015, yeah. Which we don't even know if the government had a hand in they those shows. Have. They may have, yeah. But they were not doing these level of shows on this regularity. And ask yourselves why they're not doing any shows in any other parts of the Middle East. Do those fans not deserve WWE shows? If they were not being paid by the government, I don't think you would have almost any scrutiny of these shows. You would get some, but it would be when you watch that Greatest Royal Rumble show, that's probably a must-watch show for anyone that wants to dive into this topic and watch the presentation on that show, where literally they got the Daivari brothers to represent Iran against Mansoor representing Saudi Arabia in the midst of a proxy war. That yeah. they're stoking real life tensions, and listen to the reaction of that crowd as they are playing off those nations.
Yeah, it's the one show before Jamal Khashoggi is murdered, and they're quite heavy handed, not only with that angle, but with the they play a video, you know, basically promoting Mohammed bin Salman as a political leader, as the crown prince, and talking about what a great job he's doing, implementing all these progressive policies. Women can drive again. He's doing some really special things. Envisioned, you know, 2030 is a great thing.
So, like, again, I don't begrudge performers that go and do these shows. I understand that they are in a position where you do have to understand that I have a job to perform, but I think that that also does come with some of your fans that are going to have those questions. Like today, it was announced that CBS is going to end up paying Donald Trump this $16 million figure over this Kamala Harris edited interview. And you have this institution in 60 Minutes that this is such a stain on the legacy of that program and every news arm of CBS. Now, if you're somebody in that news ecosystem, are you to give up your career and your job because your parent company is really just bending the knee here? I don't have that expectation of people. But at the same time, there's going to be a lot of criticism of CBS for acquiescing to this ridiculous demand. And if you're a CM Punk... And
Bill Owens resigned, who's the executive producer of 60 Minutes on CBS.
Bill Owens is
some people, yeah.
Stepping up. But like, I don't have that expectation that if you're a WWE performer that you have to quit the company to do this. And a Punk doing this show, it is to the benefit of your career that is winding down to make good with these big, you know, these very important shows for the company. But at the same time, there is a price on the back end where your statements are not just erased from history. And you have a fan base that I think digs much more deeper into the CM Punk ethos than many other performers, that it does show you that a CM Punk is going to be so much more of a lightning rod for this than for, say, a Sami Zayn or anybody else on the roster.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chalk Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chalk-tees.com/post-wrestling.
I hope we get to know the story, the backstory of what led to this apology, if anything, if this was not just a spontaneous apology on his part. Was he asked to do it privately? Clearly, he was not asked to do it publicly. Did WWE ask him? Did the government nudge this along to help make this happen? Was this just something that they decided to do to try to mitigate the negative reaction he was going to receive from the crowd? I would like to know. If there's anybody in WWE, there's only a handful of people who should feel as secure as he does, right? And just only a couple people who you could begin to argue are bigger stars than him in WWE. He's been a huge star for years. He made a lot of money, I'm sure, wrestling for AEW and before that, and doing whatever other projects he does. And now, there's nobody who has the financial and the professional security much greater than he does, who could, you know, push the boundaries if he wanted to. And he does seem to be a pretty principled person sometimes, with the exception of this. So I'm not saying what he should do, but he certainly opened himself up to legitimate criticism.
There's no incentive for him to address this now, but I would be curious if there does come a time that he would ever talk about this. And maybe like he has his genuine beliefs on this somehow being the right move to him to make that is not career oriented. I'd leave that to him. But while all people are kind of running cover for CM Punk, CM Punk is not the one that is pushing back on any of this or making any public statements. He's kind of in a position where he cannot. So I understand that. But I also, like, I don't get the idea of, well, just bury your head in the sand and just don't ask questions about this stuff, or don't talk about this stuff either, which is like another sentiment where if you want to be someone that, hey, you two guys, you just always just bring this stuff up and you inject all of these politics into. On this occasion, this was the WWE opening the door on this one. I think everything is completely fair game for whatever your reaction you want to be. Pro-punk, anti-punk, somewhere in the middle. This was the story going into it, and it was the dominant story going in and coming out of this. And the idea that you just are going to wipe past this and ignore what the real politics of this whole series of events are,
I think you're being naive. When you're taking $100 million a year from a government, it's not the people. They're not drawing $100 million a year in ticket sales or from, you know, private media network. They're drawing $100 million a year in a guaranteed site fee from the government. When you're doing that, it doesn't take reporters or people in media to make this about politics. That's what it is. It's about people who make very important policies that govern people's lives. And you're in a very lucrative relationship with them. I think some of the reactions to the thing that I wrote was very positive. And I think some of that is from people who are primed to and already hate Punk because of, you know, any number of reasons, including the falling out in AEW. And like, I don't dislike CM Punk. I think he's one of the most interesting figures. I would say he's probably the most interesting figure in wrestling. I might argue that.
I think this past week in our time is just the latest example of that, of like all these touchstones.
Maybe him and
pro wrestling.
And I think this is not like, oh, he's a terrible person and a terrible person for this industry. I'm a CM Punk Hall of Fame voter. Are you?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And I don't think that's going to change because of this. But just this is more, I think, a reflection of the way that the world is becoming, especially around Saudi Arabia, like Formula One. What about Formula One? That's a good what about. What about all, you know, what about all the boxing events that take place in Riyadh at the behest of Turki Alşaykh? It's a broader cultural and political phenomenon around. You just take a lot of money, an inordinate amount of money, to put on your show. You don't really have to think about it that much, and you cooperate to the extent that this government wants you to play a video or something like that, or apologize for past comments, and this is where the sports washing term comes from. You're improving the image of this company worldwide. So if you're one of these people who sits there and watches these events in Saudi Arabia by WWE, and you say, what are these idiots talking about? Like, Saudi Arabia is a government that does bad things. Looks like a pretty normal event to me. Stop complaining about it. That is exactly the product. That's the product that costs $50 million. It's this normal looking event in this normal looking country that I have no reason to believe anything other than it has a normal government. That's looks like the combat sports capital of the world to me. Yeah, maybe we'll visit it. Maybe we'll have better relations with this government and look past some of their human rights abuses and not pressure them to improve on those things and to change those things. That's what they're buying for $50 million per event.
And I think it's exemplified at the highest end by Ari Emanuel. I don't think there's any better example of this, of one of the few people that was willing to put his money where his mouth was in 2018 and reject an investment from Saudi Arabia in light of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and then did an about face multiple years later. And
all governments do bad things. That's exactly his argument. His explanation.
His rebuttal on Freakonomics was pretty much, I don't know why I decided to do that. You know, it's just like, he didn't have any cogent answer other than it's like the negative
reach of the quote that he said. Really don't even know what he's speaking about, why the company paid back $400 million, Emanuel said on the Freakonomics podcast. I'm not defending what they did. He's talking about Saudi Arabia. Every country does bad things. Everybody thinks things are black and white, and I have a tendency to do that too. Governments do bad things. Let's just say that and then work through all our emotional ethics.
I encourage people to watch The Dissident. It's a very thorough documentary, and you can ask if this is just normal governmental action that takes place on a daily basis. But that was sort of what am I giving up all this money for? Is it this altruistic action that I'm ultimately going to be rewarded for? Like, yeah, there will be some pats on the back for something like this, but I'm giving up all of this versus I take this money, and what is the downside? I'll get some critics. I'll upset a wrestling site. Like, and that's how all these companies view this. It's like, it's almost like a sign of weakness if you're to place like ethics above profit. And that's just where we are. And yeah, we can use the whole fiduciary duty argument, but I think that's a real easy cover that can ultimately defend yourself against literally anything. Like, you
can. And when he gave the money back, he was running Endeavor. Endeavor, that's 2019. Endeavor has not gone public, did not go public for a couple of years later. So my question, which I would have to ask, we have to talk to a securities lawyer, is could there be a viable shareholder class action against you for not taking sovereign wealth money to do especially if it's like, you know, five times what a normal event of that type is, you know. You could have a shareholder lawsuit come up here and say, look, you had this great deal on the table and you didn't take it. And you cost us what the stock price would have been, which would have been higher. You owe us millions of dollars now.
Is there any kind of precedent? That would be the question. Is there any precedent of any board making that argument towards an entity that it would? But you know what? You're not going to find too many examples of any companies that would make that stand, that yes, this is a short-term hit for us, but we feel that the overall brand damage that we could incur from this presents long-term effects on the brand.
And there's the thing, it's like, you're not, is W suffering brand damage from this? Is Formula One suffering brand damage from? No.
No. like that's
UFC.
Yeah, that's. I mean, UFC. You can look at it many different ways. Like it has. You know, I'm sure that there has been some of people, but the overall net, it's been a massive net positive for the UFC to go this direction. And we got a very clear instance of that this week with WWE as well. The last thing just about the article that you wrote. And again, this was very clearly an opinion piece that you wrote. It was very well written.
Was this satire?
You know,
I've heard secondhand. I try to avoid the responses to things.
I think most people got it. And if you didn't, then you know what?
Someone told me that there were some comments that people did not understand that it was satire, even though at the very end, because I know in the past and some of these other things that I've done,
that's like the figurative, maybe we
have people who are not English speakers or that's not their first language. I think they might miss it. I wrote at the bottom, this is satire. Maybe these were people who are high ranking authoritarian officials.
Yes,
in that case.
That's it. I don't think you're going on any trip there anytime soon. I would not encourage it, but, you know, this is obviously a big departure from what you typically write about. And I thought this was like a good area that you can discuss sort of doing something tonally very, very different from what you regularly do.
Have I destroyed my credibility?
No, I think absolutely.
I tried to ask you essentially that when I showed you this. I was like, do you want to run this? I debate, though, whether I should, especially in the context of reporting on really serious subjects like we're going to talk about in a minute, about lawsuits and things like that, whether I should – how often I should – delve into opinion, whether it's ruining some perception of neutrality that I would otherwise have, or on the other hand, whether it's just being transparent about what I think, or what I ultimately conclude, though, is that I don't do this often, but there are cases where it's just so obvious, where it's like the volcano has erupted and nobody's talking about the volcano erupting. And I think things are warranted. I wrote something about Nick Khan at the beginning of the year around the Lee Fitting hiring, which we had learned why Lee Fitting had left ESPN before it came to WWE. I wrote something about Tony Khan around that time too. But it's probably only going to be occasional.
My own two cents is that I think, first of all, if you're searching for neutrality, like you're never going to land that with people. Like you can have, and I would seriously classify you of the people that I've dealt with in this industry, I would put no one higher than you in terms of that kind of compass when it comes to attempting that. Like I put you at that very top level, and even at that, you're going to get people that are going to feel you are pro this, anti that. There's no escaping that. And I think to chase that is, what are you eliminating by playing into that? And it's important pieces like you wrote on Monday. I think people want your opinion because you are as qualified as anyone to write about it. You're a fantastic writer, especially when it comes to like that tone that I think just encompasses so many great points in it. And I don't think that divorces you from doing serious reporting as well. Like, this is like, it's a certain test of, you know, the audience and understanding the work that you do. When they tune into this show, it would be very bland if you were to just come on here and just read your articles and not opine and share your own thoughts. Like, we're all going to have our thoughts on things. The key being fair should be the objective. It doesn't mean that opinions necessarily have to eliminate a fairness in delivering it, and you're labeling it as such. Yeah. Like, this is opinion, and like that would be one thing to absolutely make clear when you're putting a piece like that out.
Yeah, it's the first letter, it's the first word in the headline. I think that's important. I think it's very easy to just write stuff and just put your words out there, as opposed to just letting people guess and figure out whether what you're talking about is actually original information that you are primarily reporting, or whether you're just theorizing and analyzing. I think there's often a disconnect between, well, is this person analyzing or are they reporting new information?
You can go over to postwrestling.com and read Brandon's piece, and I'm sure it will circle back. I'd also encourage people to check out our interview with Karim Zidane from a week ago going into this, which was before the apology, and kind of goes into a lot of these topics as well, and the the what about arguments as well. But we have a bunch of other stuff to get to. We went lengthier on this than I thought we would. We're now going to shift gears to what I thought would be our focus on Monday, but then the Brandon piece just was the tidal wave, a tidal wave at Post Wrestling, I can confirm. And that was the WWE Unreal details that Brandon and I were able to gain knowledge of through a source close to the production. And we have now the descriptions of the five episodes, which will drop on July 29th. And quickly going through just some of the keynotes, the first episode will focus on the Raw premiere on Netflix from the Intuit Dome back in January, featuring the CM Punk Seth Rollins match and spotlights on Punk, Rhodes, and Rhea Ripley. The second episode on the men's Royal Rumble match, the program between Cody Rhodes and Kevin Owens, which included their ladder match at the Rumble, and Jey Uso winning that year's or that month's Rumble. The third focuses on the female talent. This is with Chelsea Green winning the women's U.S. title, Charlotte Flair coming back from injury, the women's Royal Rumble and Elimination Chamber matches from February and March, and a piece dedicated to Bianca Belair. The fourth one is probably going to be the most interesting in terms of how they handle the John Cena heel turn and how they went to great lengths to keep it a secret. The execution of the turn at Elimination Chamber in Toronto and appearances by Nick Khan, Dwayne Johnson, obviously, and Brian Gewurz as well. So that'll be a real interesting handling, Brandon, because I think that's probably, if people are looking at these five episodes, the one that is going to draw the most attention.
And we do have in here that people representing Dwayne Johnson, if not himself, are sending notes to the production team about how he is going to be edited or you know, presented in these episodes.
And the fifth focuses on WrestleMania 41 and you know, the top matches, including Cena and Cody Rhodes, and sort of just also emphasizing like the ongoing nature of WWE, where there's a, like, Paul Levesque has used this analogy many times in the past about, you know, WrestleMania ends and then I'm handed a stack of papers for Raw the next night. Well, it sounds like you're literally going to see that on this episode. Again, Brandon and I have not seen these episodes, so we're not, you know, being vague here. These are the details we were provided, and it sounds like Paul Levesque is going to be sort of your narrative guide throughout these five episodes as well. But
that's what you would think from the trailer, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does feel like a Paul Levesque-led vehicle, but I think just thinking about these details, I think it's going to be most interesting how Dwayne Johnson comes across, especially in those last two episodes. It doesn't sound like his absence from WrestleMania is going to be addressed, and Johnson had mentioned on the Pat McAfee show that after Elimination Chamber, he was going to just, you know, fade into the background and not be part of the Mania buildup.
Yeah. It sounds like, you know, ideas that he may have presented originally did not come to fruition. And coincidentally or not, he was not a part of WrestleMania.
Yeah. So they've been filming this over the past, since around WrestleMania 40 of last year. And then it really ramped up in November. And our understanding is that these five episodes will drop and then an additional five episodes sometime in early 2026 will be dropping on Netflix as well. So that report is up at postwrestling.com if you want to read more about our reporting. WWE and Vince McMahon filed motions earlier this week in the Janelle Grant case, which Grant's team is trying to move towards the discovery phase. And what possibly could WWE and Vince McMahon have any issue with this movement? Were they just like, cool, let's line up a timetable?
They have an issue with it entirely. Yeah, they don't want there to be any discovery.
None.
And as we talked, so this was expected. This is not a surprise filing. This was due on the day that it was filed, after Grant filed her filings that were due on the day that it was filed. So she was saying, this is what I request and why I request it. And we knew that this was coming a week later. And as we talked about at that time, I said, they're going to look at this and say, this has nothing to do with arbitration. But I should set that table, right? This is about arbitration discovery. This is about evidence only related to arbitration. So the judge said, we're not going to do discovery about this case overall, of course, which is a sex trafficking case. She alleges that she was sex trafficked, that she was sexually assaulted. WWE and Vince McMahon are defendants here. And there's an arbitration clause in the NDA, and it has to be decided whether that arbitration clause should be enforced or not. Grant says no. So the judge said, there's not going to be discovery related to this entire case, but I will allow you to request arbitration, motion related discovery related to the question of arbitration. So that's what she did last week, Monday. And she requested some 20 categories of items, including minutes from board of directors meetings, internal communications over a 6.5 year timeline, as well as any drafts of the NDA and various other information related to the NDA. And WWE and Vince came back on Monday and said, you're not entitled to any of this. The judge should say no to all of this because you haven't even raised an allegation about why the arbitration clause, why you were coerced into the arbitration clause. And this is something we've talked about a few times specific to this issue, which is kind of nuanced. She claims that she was coerced into signing this NDA, but she doesn't raise an allegation that I can see, and this is certainly what the defendants are saying. She doesn't raise a specific allegation to the arbitration provision. Mm-hmm. And according to Rent-A-Center v. Jackson, always remember Rent-A-Center v. Jackson, Antonin Scalia, you have to make an arbitration clause unenforceable. It's not enough that I coerce you into the contract. I have to coerce you specifically, unequally to the rest of it, to the arbitration clause.
And when it comes to, the actions that Janelle Grant alleged happened after the NDA was signed, I know we've gone over this a couple of times. How important is that? Because the more and more we seem to go into this, like, it feels as though WWE and Vince McMahon are going to have pretty solid footing when it comes to up until the NDA was signed at the end of January 2022.
Right. She hasn't raised any of that yet. I mean, the defendants have anticipated that potential argument, and they have anticipated the law that is potentially related to that, the FAA, the Ending Forced Arbitration Act. But Grant herself has not raised that. She did not raise it in her discovery requests. I don't know if it makes sense to or not. So Grant still has to respond to the motions to compel arbitration themselves. She's not done that yet. That deadline, as of now, is not even established. That deadline was going to be July 11th, but the judge came out the next day on Tuesday yesterday and said that we're postponing that, which made sense because I was thinking about writing this article up. Like she's gonna have to make a decision. The judge is gonna have to make a decision on this very quickly because there's gonna be very little time left for Grant to file an opposition to the motion to compel arbitration. Everybody following me here? So that's gonna be sometime in the future. So. What I'm saying is maybe at that point she will make an argument about why the FAA is important to her argument. Maybe she's going to raise why the allegations that she alleges took place after the signing of the NDA are important to why arbitration should not be enforced. But that's when is that going to happen? Maybe late July, maybe well after that.
And so Grant now has until what is it July 11th or has that date been pushed back?
No, so that has been postponed. We have no due dates that are established at this point, I think. What we're waiting for now is the judge is going to make a decision on this discovery issue. The judge is going to say either there's no discovery allowed whatsoever or some of it's allowed or all of it's allowed. And then we'll get, an opposition to the motions to compel by Grant, which take that discovery into account if there is any.
How much of the Sean Combs case have you been following today since the verdict has come down? Sean Combs, he has not been found guilty regarding sex trafficking, but yeah. He was found guilty of two lesser charges. But if you've been following this case, which has been going on for 8 weeks in New York, there are a lot of similarities, both with like the two plaintiffs that,
and this is a criminal case.
This is a criminal case. This is not civil. They have relied heavily on like text messages and trying to prove that the two women were willing to participate in these freak offs. And they have, and their argument was that, you know, they were being forced to, that this was, you know, they were in fear of the retaliation if they did not participate in any of this. But it's hard to read this case and not just draw some comparison points to what's being alleged in the Vince McMahon WWE case.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I haven't followed this as closely as Vince's situation, but to the extent that I've read about this case, it seems like there are much more detailed allegations here than there would be against Vince, which is not to diminish Grant's allegations, to not to say that something horrendous did not happen to her, but in terms of in terms of evidence or in terms of a lot of allegations. So what we have, you don't know, is Sean Combs organizing, I don't know how many of these so-called freak-offs where he would bring prostitute, male prostitutes in and his girlfriend at the time, and then they would all have sex and all of this. It's hard to see how this would it's hard to see how Vince's case would not be less strong than this case, in which this case they're getting some convictions on lesser charges on transportation.
Combs has been acquitted of sex trafficking and racketeering, but convicted of transportation to engage in prostitution.
Yeah. So he's been convicted of transporting male prostitutes, I guess. But not of sex trafficking. And, you know, I think people want to look at who the president is and his relationship with Vince and say, this is clearly the you know, Trump and his friend Vince getting these charges out of the way. But I mean, that's a theory. I don't see evidence to support that, as much as maybe they didn't feel confident in prosecuting a case. Then again, we do know that a grand jury was convened. Grand juries usually indict, but this one has not, at least not yet. Just to keep everybody up to date, Vince's side is that this is that the criminal investigation is all over with, all done. They've been saying that since January. Then there was that appeals case in February, which referred to the investigation as quote unquote ongoing. I think, you know, there was a stay on the case that was lifted on December 11th of last year. And that stay was in place at the request of U.S. attorneys at SDNY. And then it was lifted without charges being filed. You know, we all kind of assumed that, well, maybe by December 10th, there'll be an indictment, or maybe there won't be if the stay is lifted. The stay was lifted. So it doesn't look like there's going to be any criminal case at this point. Now, new allegations could always come out. New evidence could always come out. But no expectation that that's going to happen.
And we'll just add this. This comment was sent to us from Grant's team after the motions were filed. Vince McMahon and WWE are attempting to block basic discovery requests that go to the heart of whether the NDA and its arbitration clause are valid. If they have nothing to hide, they should embrace this opportunity for transparency. So that was their comment, and that was reflected in the story that is up at postwrestling.com. Now we're going to move on to AEW, because tonight is both Dynamite's 300th episode and Collision's 100th episode, which is wild that these two things are happening in the same week and are being taped on the same night. But to mark the occasion, Tony Khan appeared on the Rich Eisen show, and last week we talked about his comments to Yahoo, where he had stated year over year they were up in their viewership. And let's hear,
which is false,
Tony Khan's updated reflection on where things are and with the Q2 analysis as well. So this is the closest we have to an AEW earnings call.
For AEW in Q4, we had a great audience, and we signed a new deal, an extension to stay at TBS and TNT, but also to simulcast on Max. So in Q1, not only did we become one of the top streaming shows on Max, but our audience on TBS actually got bigger, the overall audience and the demo share. So we just got the Q2 numbers officially in. Q2 just ended yesterday, and Q2 was up from Q1. So two straight quarters on both TBS with Wednesday Night Dynamite and TNT for Saturday Night Collision.
Yes.
The ratings have been going up each quarter, and we've been building a streaming audience. So like you said, you can build an audience on cable. And, you know, these days it's nice to have a success story on cable. But also, like you said, the power of streaming, you've seen it. And for us, Max has been such a great partner. So it's a really exciting time for AEW with what's going on TBS, TNT, and Max, growing and building the audience. But for the wrestling fans, the shows have been better than ever.
That was Tony Khan on the Rich Eisen show. How did he do this week, Brandon?
Much better. You could say that this is spin still, but much better. So I've prepared math, as I warned you. So last week, where he was saying things that were not true about his ratings, last week he was talking about year-over-year growth. This week he's talking about sequential growth from last quarter to this quarter. And it's mostly true what he's saying. Total viewership was up 1% in Q4 from Q3.
Hey, that's up.
I'm sorry.
That's up. You get 51%, you pass.
Q1 was up from Q4, which is notable considering that this is the that was the first quarter with yep. Max around, and then Q2 was up 1% from Q1. So up is up, even if it's 1% up, I suppose. However, if you look at the demo, Dynamite, oh, we should mention too, okay, Collision, and this is excluding preemptions, only including non-preemptions. Collision was up 18%, so more actually significantly.
That would not include episodes that had like an NBA lead-in, for instance. Would that be right?
This is episodes that started at 8 o'clock on Saturday night. So I would have to go back and look to see did some of them still start right at 8 but have a tremendous lead-in? I don't know. If there's cases of that, it's not often, right? But in the demo, Dynamite was down 2% in this quarter sequentially and 8.5% in Q1. Collision was up in the demo, though, this quarter by 5%. So it's if we're talking about total viewership, sure, it's mostly true. Pretty mild for Dynamite. Again, this is different from what he was saying last week, where he was trying to say that viewership was up year over year when it's actually down by double digits.
Well, I mean, when you look at that, I'm just scanning here. I think there was one Saturday show that got like an NBA lead-in at its normal time. The rest would all qualify as like preemptions and outside the slot. I mean, Q2 to me is more impressive in the fact that they were going up against NBA and NHL playoff competition for a lot of those Wednesdays and Saturdays. And you throw in the simulcast aspect as well, if we're comparing this to Q4 numbers as well. So I would say that, like, overall, like, you can certainly argue that AEW, at the very least, has subsided any kind of, lowering that we were seeing in the end of last year. And I would say, if you were to ask anybody going into January, that simulcasting was going to take some kind of chunk out of this, and that has not been the case. So, again, like, we don't know what these numbers are truly on Max, which I don't know if Tony Khan knows what these numbers are.
I don't know. I question if he does. And our listeners knew this already, that sequentially, we were talking, I think it was last week, and yes, the numbers look like they're up. I haven't updated this for another week, but TV viewership ranking and live event attendance according to WrestleTix is up. Now the listeners have also alerted me that that Tony Khan has tweeted his own graph just minutes ago. He might be watching. So what's he showing here?
How do you assess, first of all, the visuals of this? Like,
this is a great visual. Nice. This is a very, very nice graphic. AEW in 2025, he's got P2554, which is WBD's, which is the exact demo, I guess, that WBD is interested in. This is live, same date in thousands. Okay, so he's saying, what is he showing here? So these numbers, okay, this is sequential, yeah. I suppose when you look at the 25 to 54 instead of the 18 to 49, it may actually be positive. But what we are looking at, the 18 to 49 rating and demo, which is actually negative in most comparisons, sequentially even. So this looks right. We'll check it out later, though.
Okay. Well, Brandon, we'll go through this. I like these graphs that are coming out. Also in that this same discussion with Rich Eisen, Tony Khan, like,
yeah, this was his P2 numbers check out. His P2 numbers check out.
Okay, then that gets a thumbs up. Tony Khan also addressed next year's All In, or we should just, whether it's All In or you presume it would be All In, and a return to Wembley Stadium.
AEW All In Texas, the largest domestic show in its 6-year history. That's the affair that used to be, if you will, in Wembley Stadium
the
last 2 years.
Back to Wembley next year too, by the way. So you know, Coldplay had booked this weekend out years in advance.
Blaming it on Coldplay. Okay.
But it's going to be great. I can't wait to do Global Life Field in Dallas, go back to Wembley next year.
Okay.
We've put 81,000 fans in Wembley for AEW All In, and I can't wait to go back and do it again next year.
So this was, I mean, they had announced this last year that they would be back in 2026, but this is, you know, concrete. Looking this up, so Coldplay, which are on this insane tour right now, they're doing 4 nights here in Toronto this week at Rogers Stadium, and then they're doing 8 nights at Wembley Stadium between August 22nd and September the 8th. So that certainly checks out. 8 nights at Wembley Stadium. four, six, seven, eight, nine nights at Wembley Stadium. So get your tickets.
It might be 10. Three, six, nine.
Well,
ten.
They've got,
I count 10.
They've got these two at Craven Park. Am I counting wrong here? Well, maybe it's 10.
Who knows?
Anyway, a lot of shows for Coldplay.
Nobody listening is going to Coldplay at Wembley here.
Probably not. Going back to Wembley, I think even a year out, that sounds exceptionally ambitious.
Yes, it does. Well, I mean, what are they going to do in Texas? 20,000 probably. They're not there yet, right? But they'll get there to 20,000. It'll be respectable.
Maybe a little bump at the end, like 25 you'd be shooting for as like a kind of best case scenario. Like, which is, you know, like, it sounds like Dave Meltzer's reported the gate is around $2.5 million, which if that checks out, like that's an exceptionally strong gate number for AEW.
Yeah. Will it be lower than whatever they deliver this year? I think that's a good over-under.
At Wembley?
Yeah.
I'd say if you draw 20,000 at Wembley, that's...
Yeah. I can you see him drawing a lot more than 20,000 next year, though? Is the traveling fan less likely to go, you know, the worldwide traveling fan less likely to go to UK than Dallas?
I would say, like, obviously, like, from the numbers we've seen through WrestleTix, like, the O2 show looks like that's going to be a big success for them. That seems like the appropriately sized venue for where AEW is now. It's hard to say, like, if... I think you really need to catch some gigantic wave of momentum for, you know, just shooting for last year's numbers at Wembley to me sound pretty ambitious. Like if they were going to Wembley this summer, like I just can't imagine that one being much higher than where the Texas show is now. Like it was probably a good idea this year to take the All In franchise to the US or just to another market, period. You know, if the money was there, if you felt like you would get the traveling fan, I mean, to me, Mexico is such a ripe market. Like, even if you were to do Arena Mexico, but I just don't see that they see that as the most profitable
ticket prices
regions.
For one thing. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, you know what Tony Khan would say? They have the best ratings in the UK. I can't check that though. But they're popular in the UK. It's so strong and. They put 80,000 people in Wembley Stadium, which is they sold 81,000 tickets for that show.
Yes, yeah. No one has to get their tattoo changed at all. Like that's a number you can have cemented on your arm if you got that tattoo. All right, pretty dark story here that's been going on for a couple of weeks ever since the arrest here. So this comes from the Fox affiliate in Altamonte Springs, Florida. Canadian man is facing federal stalking charges after authorities say he traveled from Canada to Florida and attempted to break into the Pascal County home of pro wrestler Liv Morgan. Authorities say that Sean Chan, a 41-year-old man from Canada, flew to Orlando the same day his passport was issued and drove to WWE star Liv Morgan's home on May 31st. Surveillance footage captured Chan circling the house with what appeared to be a rifle, later determined to be a BB gun, that he reportedly found on Morgan's porch. He attempted to enter the home, appeared to search for a spare key, and left a handwritten note before leaving after more than 2 hours. Morgan was not home at the time. Chan was arrested 3 days later at the WWE Performance Center in Orlando after showing up for an event. He was recognized by security and taken into custody by deputies. He now faces charges of burglary in Pascal County and federal charges of interstate stalking. So what's a terrible story.
Sean Chan is being held in prison in Pasco County Detention Center. He has a hearing scheduled for July 18th at 11 a.m. This is a federal case. He's been federally indicted, and I suppose that's because he's a foreign national. He's from Canada. He's from Scarborough, Ontario. So I don't want to speculate what's going to happen to him, or I don't know what's how this will be handled since he's not a resident or a citizen of the U.S., but he according to the court filings, he got a passport, and the same day he got the passport, he took a plane from Ontario to Orlando, and I believe it was in Orlando for several days, and then went to Liv Morgan's home.
Yeah, I mean it's extremely troubling on a number of fronts. I think this does bring to the forefront just the ease at which. You know, if you are bound and determined to track down some of these performers, it is doable. And I think we've seen this case. I mean, in an even scarier case involving Sonya Deville a number of years ago.
Where someone actually entered while she was there.
Entered the home while she was there.
Liv Morgan was fortunately not home when this person went to her home and tried to get in. It's trying to like open the door by force, was not able to enter, and she wasn't home anyway. But yeah, grab the BB gun or grab the airsoft gun from the porch.
Yeah, but like you have the combination of here is, you know, a central location in the Performance Center where you had this national television show that airs weekly, and these fans like will know where these people are going to be on a weekly basis. Now, not all the main roster performers, but still, like you are talking about, you're just not going. There's very little barrier between fan and performer when you're talking about like what is basically like a makeshift gym that they are at every single Tuesday, and you know where and when they're going to be there at the Performance Center. It's definitely one of those.
And that's where stories. He was arrested because he tried to go to the Performance Center the following Tuesday for NXT.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is someone that was, you know, obviously like a major threat to Liv Morgan and potentially other talent as well.
And he left a rambling note at the door. When he left too.
But you hear about these stories, and these are kind of the extreme cases, but even like the stories about the, you know, we kind of hear from, especially from female performers, the amount of vitriol they get online, and probably a lot of stuff that is just dismissed because it's online. But there's a thin line between the connection that people can have online to tweet at someone versus in real life, like trying to track down these people. And it's definitely very, very concerning when you hear about these stories and people acting on some of these ideas and stuff, and being able to locate their home address. Like that's frightening stuff.
Yeah. It's not the first time there's been stalkers in and around the Performance Center. There's a memorable case from several years ago. And those are the things that we do know about. Yeah.
Some talent have mentioned like stuff that has been mailed to their homes as well, like tracking down their addresses and mailing them stuff, like whether it's, you know, just stuff to just sign stuff. But still, it's like when someone is able to track down your home address, like it's very threatening. And I think that just kind of underlines it here in these extreme cases as well. All right, we're going to wrap up on just a couple of ratings notes. So last Thursday, Collision aired on Thursday night, and it generated 285,000 viewers and a 0.08 in the 18 to 49 demo. It was eighth for the night on cable in prime time. Dave Meltzer made note that this apparently aired live on the West Coast, but AEW was not aware it was airing on the West Coast until it did, and therefore there was no mention of this on Dynamite the night before. So I don't know if that fully checks out, because I was not aware of this until I heard that. But that would at least be an asterisk to this number on a Thursday night for AEW, which was well down, obviously, from their previous Saturday night audience.
Yeah, that's a preemption airing, whatever.
SmackDown on Friday, a tape-delayed show from Riyadh, 1,450,000 viewers and a 0.41 in the demo. So it was number one on television in the demo, and a really big number for men 18 to 49, which was their highest mark since April 25th, and this was going up against the NHL draft.
Yes.
Are you tuning in to see who the Sabres grabbed?
No. But it beat the NHL draft, as you kind of mentioned. Could you watch this live on Netflix?
Yes. I could watch it live. And,
okay.
And they had major problems on the Netflix, the worldwide.
Right.
It went down for about a half hour, and they had to clean that up for the USA Network airing as well.
Was Tony Khan responsible for that?
That was not insinuated until now. So you're going to get some conspiracy theorists coming your way. Okay, you might be looking out for former Nexus members that might take issue with this.
Wasn't there like a WCW situation with that in the Money Not Wars era?
They insinuated WCW had something to do with the Beware of Dog power outage. That was Eric at work.
It must be. It can't be our fault. Yeah.
And then finally, we have the Netflix numbers for Raw from June the 23rd, 2.6 million global views after 7 days. It ranked fourth in the U.S. I think it was third in Canada off the top of my head.
Three in the U.S., four globally.
Okay, four globally. So, yeah, I mean, was kind of a standard number. Was there anything you took from this one? They were behind the waterfront, Ginny in Georgia, and America's Sweethearts, the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, season two, in terms of global rankings.
It's continuing to level out. This is on the lower end of what they've done, but I don't see it as alarming. We were estimating this, right, to be down from the prior year based on my various assumptions, forward-looking statements. It's a number that is maybe okay. I'm real curious to know what they think of it internally, but it does rank high. Number four globally? Number three.
It was ranked in six countries, along with Mexico, Bolivia, Bahrain, and Sri Lanka. And the Night of Champions from Saturday was ranked in 10 countries in the top 10. So it was somewhere under 1.8 million views. Of course, this excludes the U.S. But if there are two hotspots in the world, it's Bolivia and Canada. Okay, they will literally watch anything with WWE attached to it from just analyzing these rankings every week.
And attendance for this show, this is the 23rd, in where was this?
Columbus,
Ohio. 13,000, according to WrestleTix, which is higher than the last time they were there for Raw about a year ago. 9,000 some odd. And it's higher than any number we've got since WrestleTix has been tracking this stuff since the return to touring.
Yep, and they did over 13,000 for Pittsburgh this past Monday as well, for the double taping as well. Which
somebody continues to buy these expensive tickets.
That's the key. It's they're a freight train out of control, selling tickets by the boatload. All right, well there you have it, everyone. Now
the marketplace is frothy.
Tons of froth, okay? Tons of froth, tons of foam for the it's a simple story. It's a really simple story.
Doesn't that mean the marketplace is frothy? Doesn't it mean that the market is overvalued? Because there's froth that's not real. It's not something you can actually drink. It's just froth.
It's an illusion. It's a mirage.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that what he's saying?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like there's a lot of steak. We're not just sizzle. We provide a lot of steak. I mean, I could get behind that one. Maybe Mark needs to update some of his talking points, and we do a really good job of keeping track of them. So
yeah, well, he's listening, so I'm sure he'll take notes.
He surpassed George Barrios in terms of sound bites for me. Okay, we should have been doing this show during the Barrios era. I think we really would have shined during that 2017, 2018 period. But we will sign off now. Again, lots of great stuff from Brandon Thurston over the past couple of days. You can catch a lot of his work up at postwrestling.com and patreon.com/WrestleNomics. He's also got a Substack where you can support all of the stuff that he is working on, giving you a state of the business. And who knows, every now and then an opinion piece may drop when Brandon is so inspired.
And I did do an analysis piece on the AEW state of consumer metrics and popularity, which we talked about the last week. We showed the image. I did some writing about that, and that's up there for subscribers. There's the new merchandise. What are the top items that are ranked on the WWE and AEW and Pro Wrestling Tees merchandise websites? That has just gone up yesterday, as well as every wrestling show. We showed some of it just now. Every wrestling show, well, the major ones, WWE and AEW, complete breakdown of what we can gather from each show in terms of TV ratings, attendance, YouTube, even cage match.
Tonight, Wei Ting and I will be live after 10 Eastern tonight on the Post Wrestling Cafe. We will be chatting about Dynamite 300 from Ontario, California, featuring Kazuchika Okada and Kota Ibushi, and a Superman promotional tie-in that they are doing with Warner Brothers. So that is coming up on Dynamite tonight. And Thursday on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are going to be going to the movies for a review of F1, the movie, starring Brad Pitt as Sonny Hayes. And can Brad Pitt turn back the clock and become a top-level driver in 2000.
Were there any races in Riyadh that are featured?
There were, I don't think in Riyadh, but there was definitely Abu Dhabi was represented.
Okay.
As long as
we get sovereign wealth in there.
Yes. So that's coming up on Thursday. PostWrestlingCafe.com. And next week, we have a guest for next week's show, Trish from the Sarah and Trish Wrestling Podcast is going to be joining us here on Pollock and Thurston. So you can look forward to that next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. For Brandon Thurston, I am John Pollock. Feed us more.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration.
Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.